fine place to jump in, actually, because I will take up where I think the discussion was ending or leading to. Jean-François asked me to speak about how recovery, the recovery movement, the notion of recovery as it is emerging in mental health requires a new research paradigm, one that is participatory and inclusive. So I will talk about that. Can you hear me? No? How about now? Yes? There's a lot of bzzz. Ah. Is that better? Okay, sorry about that. Ordinarily, I would welcome you to interrupt me and ask questions, and maybe we can do that if I can be quick with the earphones. But if you want to wait until the end, that's fine as well. So I'm going to speak about how the notion of recovery in mental health has required, or at least made demands for a new research paradigm, one that is more participatory and inclusive. So I will speak briefly about why there's a need for such a paradigm, although you've already heard it this morning, I think, from this table over here. But I'll reiterate that. What the requirements are for this new paradigm, and then I can give a couple of examples of how such a paradigm will be can be implemented based on work we've done in Connecticut over the last 10 years. There are multiple dimensions to the recovery movement, and therefore multiple demands that it places on researchers. There is, most obviously, the shift from institutional settings to community settings. There are many psychiatric researchers who still bemoan this shift because they don't have such a captive audience for their research. But that certainly poses, I think, an important challenge to researchers that people with psychiatric illness need to be informed participants rather than guinea pigs, as we heard before. There's also a shift from cure to living self-determined and meaningful lives with mental illnesses. This requires a shift in our research, or at least a new direction for research, which is how people can live with mental illnesses. There's a shift from what practitioners need to do to what people can do for themselves, which also has important ramifications for research. We're not just looking at interventions that professionals provide, including medication, but we're looking at what people do themselves in their lives in order to have a life. Mm-hmm. And this lab, there's a typo here. It should say nothing about us without us. The recovery movement emerged from the independent living movement among people with other disabilities. And the motto for this rights movement has been nothing about us without us. So basically, based on that mandate alone, obviously research will need to shift to be more participatory. There are advantages to this. People are no longer limited to the role and status of passive objects. We heard that before. Science, for those of us who are trained as clinicians, I think it's important to point out that science will no longer be limited by the Praecox-Feeling, Rumpke's Praecox-Gefühl, of incomprehensibility. This goes back now about 100 years to when psychiatry first defined psychotic disorders as someone has a schizophrenic illness when I can't understand them, when they seem alien to me. Excuse me. This core principle of psychopathology has had tremendous ramifications for research, and part of the reason why we have researched people with serious mental illnesses as opposed to conducted research with them, because our basic assumption has been that we cannot understand them. They are somehow alien to us. And the recovery movement has basically turned that on its head. We have much to learn about living with and recovering from mental illnesses. We are no longer talking about just getting rid of these conditions, but how people can live with them, and that is a new topic for research. And we have ready partners in the process. As you saw from Jean-François's data this morning, people are very excited about being included. They're very hopeful that this will change research and practice and the quality of people's lives. So we have a very ready partners for this process. The requirements are simple, I think. They're profound, but simple. People with mental illnesses are to be treated as people who may play various roles in the research process. Oh, thank you. It's not the swine flu, I promise. This includes sitting on institutional review boards as members. It includes people being consumers of scientific knowledge, as other people with other chronic illnesses can be. But it also, and it means being informed participants of research, but our focus today is it also means being research partners. Regardless of the role that they play, people with mental illnesses are to be viewed as active agents in learning how to and managing their own conditions. And I'll reiterate one more time, I can't say it enough, I think, nothing about us without us. I note here that that's at least until the free market takes over. And that's because I don't at least envision this to be a permanent situation for mental health or psychiatry. I think this is in part based on our history of oppression and torture and inhumane treatments, and that people with serious mental illnesses are taking back claim to their lives, taking back their power and control. And eventually, as my chairman of my psychiatry department said to me in 1992, we hired our first people in recovery to be staff in 1992, and the chairman of my department didn't understand why we would do that. And he said, I envision a day when mental illnesses are no different from any other illnesses. Now, if we ever get to that point, which I hope we will, then we will need participatory research no differently in mental health than we do in endocrinology or cardiology or nephrology. But for now, it's definitely more of a political statement as well as a scientific statement. Once mental health becomes part of the free market and people can choose where they go and what they buy or what they purchase with their healthcare dollars, this may not be as pressing an issue. I will use, because it's been the core of my research, I will use examples from narrative studies. These examples apply also to quantitative experimental studies, although there are obviously different issues when you get to issues of randomization. But since most of my research has been with narrative, I will use examples from there. We typically turn to stories when we are in an unexplored territory, when it's an area that we don't know much about, and I would suggest to you that that applies to living with mental illnesses. When we're concerned that a population has not been represented adequately in a public debate which directly concerns them, and when we're concerned, this is a related point, that the dominant forms of power knowledge silence or obfuscate dissenting or divergent voices. So typically this kind of research has been done with oppressed or minority populations. And I would suggest that people with serious mental illnesses qualify for both of those categories. What we typically do with such stories when we are not doing this in a participatory way is we identify, synthesize, and describe the findings of the stories. We communicate these findings both to academic audiences and to lay audiences, and we use those findings to inform public policy. That seems to have worked reasonably well in the past. So the question is, what's wrong with that? What, from the perspective of the recovery movement, is wrong with that picture? And I think we heard that, well, we saw it in the data at the end when we were talking about who owns the data, who is responsible for deciding how it's disseminated, et cetera. The question that the recovery movement raises is, whose story is it anyway? And this gets to the question that was raised in the first meeting that I could only participate in by video. When the question was raised, is the research on the research participatory? Researchers come to participatory research with their own agendas, as do people in recovery and as do policymakers, decision makers. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing to try to hide or be secretive about. Our agenda is to further knowledge and to improve the quality of care that people receive. That's not anything that I would not want to be transparent about. But that doesn't mean that I own the stories that are shared with me or told to me. The people who share those stories also have a stake in how that knowledge is then used. So the problem with the way we started out doing qualitative research is we didn't bother to stop and ask, are the people that we are studying, can they speak for themselves? Do they need the partnership with researchers in order for their voice to be heard in the public debate? And the answer to that is complicated. So in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. And we can talk about that more either today or as this process evolves, because I think it's a very interesting question. But I will give you I don't know how much time we'll have to get into these things, but I'll start with a couple of studies briefly, and then I'll try to get to the one that I think we have the most to learn from. But a first policy question that we tried to address in this fashion was the question of hospital or community living, which now hopefully seems to be an outdated question. But in the early 1990s, this was not an outdated question. It was the last round of deinstitutionalization in the United States, and people were calling for resurrection of the asylum. There were calls in the policy arena for rebuilding hospitals, reversing deinstitutionalization, taking people off the streets who were suffering and putting them back in hospitals. And we noticed at that point that the voice that was missing from that debate was that of the people most directly affected by this decision. Nobody was asking people with mental illnesses where they would prefer to live. So we did an initial study where we asked that. I won't get into the details, but it was basically, what was life like when you were in the hospital? What's life been like since you've been discharged? What's better for you? And what we learned when we asked those questions was that there really wasn't that much difference. Again, this is going back to the early 1990s. There wasn't that much difference in how people experienced their lives in the hospital and how they experienced it once they had been discharged. And if I could use the terms that my teenage daughters would use, basically life sucked in both places. And the way it was described was very similar in both places. In the hospital, one of the women described it as, I'm at the canteen every day. My mother sent money, so I'd buy cigarettes, buy candy, buy coffee, buy gum, buy soda, buy tea, buy soup, saltines and cheese and ham and bagels. And, you know, buy food and listen to the music. That was life in the hospital. But then life outside the hospital, I just sit at my table and drink soda or water and smoke and listen to the radio and get a few memories by listening to the music. Or occasionally I'll turn on the TV and watch a pretty good movie. And we get together and sometimes we go out to McDonald's and have a little bite to eat. This gentleman, when asked further about how he saw his life in the community evolving in terms of the future, he said, well, there's nothing really out here for me. I say a prayer, say, God, help me or heal me or take me, but it hasn't worked so far. It's hard for me to concentrate, and sometimes when someone says something, I may get a reminder of the past. I live in the past. Every day is the present, but it holds nothing for me. As far as the future, I have no future worth mentioning. I know I'm going to die mentally ill. I don't know what else I'll die from physically, but as far as hopes, I don't see any hope. I fear that I'll get sicker and linger on and suffer more than I'm suffering now. So from the perspective of someone whose experience is this, the question of hospital or community really missed the point, and that's one of the things we learned. We were asking the wrong question. It wasn't just a matter of where would you prefer to receive your treatment, which was basically what the question boiled down to. The question should have been, what can we do to enable you, whether it's in the hospital or the community, to have a decent, dignified, and safe and meaningful life? We didn't get to that question until a few years later when we were asked to address the issue of recidivism. So now we're talking about the mid to late 1990s. People were getting out of hospitals but coming back to hospitals, causing a lot of money for the system, not benefiting from the treatment. This emerged as a new policy issue. So how can we keep people with serious mental illnesses from coming back to the hospital once we discharge them? This is a good example of, because this study was done in a more participatory way, it's a good example of how we might have done it had we not stopped and thought, gee, what did we learn from the first study? Maybe we're asking the wrong questions, and I'll get to that in a minute. But this is a good example of how, if it's not questioned, and if people in recovery, in this case, are not brought into the process as partners in the research, we can continue on with some very problematic and unhelpful assumptions. In this case, we had assumptions about what the causes were and possible solutions were to this problem. We assumed that people were readmitted to hospitals because of relapse, and that they were relapsing either because they failed to take their medications or follow through with outpatient care, or because they were abusing substances. Those were the assumptions that were being made as this question was framed. And most of the studies in the research literature at that point were describing recidivism as the result of these two factors. So basically, it was the person's fault. and a lot of research in mental health, when you look at it from a service user or a consumer survivor's perspective, basically boils down to it's the person's fault that they're having these difficulties, or it's because the illness is incurable. Those would be the two bookends, so to speak. So if it was the person's fault, the solutions would have to focus on fixing the person, getting him or her to stop using alcohol and drugs, getting him to take his or her medication, getting him to follow through with outpatient appointments. And a number of efforts were made in the mid-1990s to address these problems, all of which led to no appreciable change in recidivism rates. They didn't work. So we learned by going out and asking people who had come back to the hospital numerous times, we learned a lot by asking them basically what was happening that they were ending up back in the hospital. Our agenda being, how can we help you from coming back? When we framed it that way, people told us that that question made no sense. Isn't that what the hospital's there for, as they said? You build hospitals for people when they're sick. I get sick, I come to the hospital. You say to me, what can I do to keep you out of the hospital? That makes no sense. Other people, most people in this study describe the hospital as a vacation. Just to clarify, we're talking about now acute inpatient care, not prolonged inpatient care. The first study was on people living in hospitals. This study was of people coming through for, say, 4 to 7 days in a hospital. They viewed it as a vacation. You take some time out in a place where there's privacy and there's care and there are lots of people to listen to you. My favorite is the last quote on this slide, which I'll read in a second. But our assumption was that each time the person comes to the hospital, they're worse. And the clinical literature suggests this. Each readmission shows a depreciation in functioning. Much to the contrary, the way it was described to us by the participants in this study was, the first time I was scared, the second time I'd been here before and I knew what to expect, but the third time it was like coming home again. Everyone was like greeting me at the door. The third time was the best. You can imagine that that was somewhat surprising to us at this point. Why did people come back to the hospital? Not because they had had relapses, but because they needed somebody to talk to, because they got tired of living on the streets, and because the reality of their lives outside the hospital had become intolerable, and they needed, as they said, a vacation. They had very clear ideas about what would have been more helpful. They really didn't see the hospital as being relevant at all to their day-to-day lives outside the hospital. They said treatment in the hospital was something like this, where they ask you questions. It was like going to school, and I passed. I passed with flying colors. Everybody loved me after I left that place. I have 10 minutes. Okay. That's okay. When asked what outpatient staff could do to be more helpful, a typical response was they can stay the hell away from me. So we learned many things from this study. The question came to what to do with these findings. We could, if we remained within our initial assumptions, we could understand and interpret these responses to be further manifestations of the illness. We could understand or interpret them as indicators of required services. So what are we going to do to decrease loneliness, to increase compliance, etc.? Or what we did in this case was to ask the people who told us these stories what they would suggest would be more helpful. So this was the first study that we did in which our participants became our partners. They didn't start out that way. They started out as participants in a study of hospital readmission, but they became partners in the process of solving the problems we were studying. So they became involved in understanding and interpreting the meaning of the stories and their implications for practice, and then, more importantly, in creating new stories that would have alternative endings. And this is one example of a study that was both qualitative and quantitative. We developed an intervention with the participants in the first cohort of interviews. We then found, we did a randomized clinical trial of that intervention funded by the National Institutes of Health, and we found that peer-delivered services, having peer role models, peer mentors, And having other people you could hang out with in the community basically led to increases in social functioning, decreased drug and alcohol use. And to me, most importantly, was this slide, which if you're, as Alain is, if you're a health services researcher, this will be a very familiar finding to you. As people were involved in the intervention, their use of outpatient services improved. When the intervention ended, they went back to the same level as they had been prior. This replicates the findings of ACT studies, for example, CERT of community treatment studies. As long as you're on the team, you do better. When the team is removed, you do worse. It's a lesson we keep learning in psychiatry, that these are long-term conditions for which people need long-term supports. In this case, we learned that in addition to being able to tell their own stories, people with mental illnesses could be collaborators in identifying and resolving the issues they were facing in their lives. And I don't have time to get into this particular issue today, but it's a very important issue in doing participatory research, which is the assumption that people are already subjects, they're already agents, they're already people, I don't know how else to put it, but they're already competent, capable adults. We don't have to wait for them to become so at a later point. And I'll just try to explain this briefly. In the United States, we have this mental health transformation initiative of the federal government, and 11 states received large amounts of money to transform their mental health system. And one of the requirements along with this money was that consumers, people in recovery, be involved in the transformation process. And some of the early meetings of these groups, because Connecticut is one of those transformation states, were discussions with decision makers primarily about what does it mean to say that people in recovery have to be included in the transformation process, and how do you know when someone's ready to be included? Who and when are they ready to be included? And those are the wrong questions to be asking. People are always already ready to be included. The question is how they are included. So we learned that because the folks that we were working with in this project were what other people would describe as difficult to engage. They were actively using substances. They were significantly disabled by their mental illnesses. They were not what a lot of people would think of as ready to engage in research. But I think that is a barrier to doing this kind of research, is thinking that people have to achieve a certain level of functioning or have to be able to behave in a certain way or have to fit somebody else's criteria of being a capable, competent adult in order to be a part of the research process. If we don't include people in this way, we don't learn as much and we risk perpetuating our previous assumptions, which have not been very useful. And this is restating what I just said, but some concerns that have emerged have been that people in recovery don't have the ability to participate. That reflects our stereotypes and stigma and discrimination against people with mental illnesses, and that they won't be interested in participating, which just from the data you saw this morning, you can see clearly is not the case. So I probably have time just for this one last study. Okay. So more recently, this has been an evolution, as you see, at least in my career, it's been an evolution of becoming more and more participatory as things go along. This last study I'll describe was a study I did not start. It was people approached me and said, people in recovery approached me and said, we're tired of doing studies that nobody takes seriously. They're part of a grassroots, statutorily required board in the state of Connecticut, and they are required to do program evaluations on an annual basis. And they got tired of seeing their program evaluations end up in trash cans. And they wanted to do a study that would have meaningful, relevant results that decision makers could not ignore. So we went through a several-month process of discussing what that might look like. They decided that rather than evaluating programs, they wanted to collect narratives. They didn't want to focus on programs, but on people. And the best way to focus on people was to ask them what their lives were like. They then went and collected the data. And they decided then that they wanted to analyze the data, and they decided then that they wanted to present the data. And they felt a real sense of ownership of the stories that they had been entrusted with. So they developed a performance piece, about a 35 to 40 minute piece, performance piece, in which they told the stories that they had collected from their own perspectives. And that was performed in front of the commissioner, the state mental health department, and his senior leadership, and family members, and people in recovery. And it was, and it's current. They just received a grant to develop a high quality video of this performance that can then be used as a teaching tool. The study basically focused on four questions: what's your life like these days? What would you like your life to be like these days? Are there ways in which mental health services could be more helpful in supporting your efforts to have a better life? And how would you spend your dollars if the choice were yours? Connecticut, as many other systems around the country, and I think in Canada too, has been playing with this idea of self-directed care, where you basically decide on the system tells you how much money is available for your services and supports, and you choose what you will use, basically. So in this study, we wanted to ask people, what would they choose if the choice were up to them? Well, since the stories sort of speak for themselves, I'll just read you a few passages. One thing that impressed the researchers, even though they themselves all had personal experiences of mental illness and recovery, they were impressed with how difficult people's lives were and how poignant their stories were. For example, I never have food, very little. I go to a food store that comes into our neighborhood every other week. There you can live on 3 loaves of bread, a bag of potatoes, and a bag of rice. My eating habits are very poor. Sometimes I go without eating for a long time. I would love to eat fresh, nourishing foods like fruits and vegetables. I dream of them. I can get a piece of watermelon so close to my mouth in my dreams, and then for some reason I can't taste it. It's hard to sleep. I'm so hungry sometimes. This is in the most affluent state in the United States that people are describing their day-to-day lives in these terms. What we found from this study, to sort of telescope it down, what people described as the most significant new finding in this study, because a lot of the stories told us things we already knew, but some of the things they told us that we hadn't really thought about before that seemed to be significant, were that most of the people in this study talked about how they didn't know how to find their way in the world. And they didn't find mental health services to be very useful in helping them find their way in the world. So this person said, even in individual counseling, I don't feel like I'm being helped, because then you can see if someone is really bad, then you have to put them in the hospital. But what's the sense of having all this knowledge? Sometimes I think you could do better with a person that didn't even have a counseling degree if they were just normal and practical and down to earth. Sometimes I found more help by talking to a relative or something about something, and they just gave me some practical, normal advice. Another person described, the medical model is not helpful for me as far as treating my depression. They say these are your symptoms. We are going to help you lessen the symptoms of your disease. Well, I say to that, how are you going to lessen symptoms of the disease if you don't work on what's causing the disease in the first place? That's like saying to someone with cancer when they still have a lot of chance left, saying, you know, this is your disease and these are your symptoms and we're just going to make you comfortable or something. No, you go after it. You go to chemotherapy, this and that, and then if you can't, that's one thing. But this is their mentality. It would be nice if I could kind of be included in my treatment plan. They look at you like you're crazy, like, oh, why do you want to do that? This sense that people had that mental health providers focused on lessening the illness gave them a sense that they had basically given up hope for the person having a life. And they didn't want to just focus on lessening their illness. They wanted to focus on how to have a life. And they didn't find mental health services to be very helpful. So when asked what they would spend their money on, a number of people described something similar to this. You know how for younger people they like the program Big Brothers, Big Sisters? I think there should be a one-on-one companionship kind of thing going on here. One person you could take a walk with who's there in case you panic out, in case you feel claustrophobic or whatever each other's problems is, but two people that are matched together according to their disabilities or handicaps that one another can help each other with common interests. They could go for a walk and help each other and go for that walk. Other people describe a similar thing. I wish I had a friend that would come and take me shopping or something, or go out and eat together and have a talk. Maybe if a family member would come with me like the first few times, just so that I can get accomplished the stuff on my own, because I don't want to be taken by the hand, but I paid this in full and the months are going by and I haven't gone. This person was talking about a health fitness center, which are very popular now in the U.S. She had paid for her membership at the fitness center, but she hadn't yet gone even once because she didn't want to go by herself. As far as what could help me, basically just having somebody to talk to, or having somebody to bounce ideas off of, or just having somebody to say, you know something, you're all right. You know, things are going to get better. Okay. Now, some people may say this is what mental health providers are supposed to be doing. But at least in the experience of the 80 people that we talked to in Connecticut, which is, as far as the United States goes, one of the states that's been more progressive in offering community-based services, this is not how people were finding their mental health services to be. There were a couple of people who did describe very positive experiences with mental health services, and what they said, I don't know why I didn't include a quote from them, what they said basically was, the staff that I work with have been terrific. They've helped me come back from my illness, and then they've helped me go on to my life. That was how one person described it, in just those terms. This has led us to come up with this idea of recovery roadmaps, how to help people go from a life of disability to a life of normality, having an ordinary everyday life, where they walk, go for walks, and go to fitness centers and things like that. And that has now become a major policy direction for the state system, based in part on this project. So when people were asked how they wanted to conduct research, what kind of research they wanted to conduct, and how they thought it could be useful, they developed what turned out to be a very exciting and very effective project, which I think has fairly significant implications for how practitioners might do their practice differently. Is that time? Okay.
Thank you very much.
There is in your packet the slides, which has another study I didn't get to, which addresses disparities and cultural issues. So it's there if you want to take a look at it.
Thank you. It has been most interesting, but I don't want to take time away from conversations. Alors, si vous voulez réagir, poser des questions, avoir des commentaires, je suis prête à naviguer dans la salle.
Thank you, Larry, for that excellent presentation. I guess the message that you're putting forth is that people in recovery took the initiative to develop this project called A Day in the Life. And I guess my question is, how were researchers involved in that project?
Oh, very good question. I was their consultant, and when they decided that they wanted to do a narrative study, I offered to train them in how to develop narrative instruments and conduct narrative interviews. And then when they decided that they didn't want to just give me the data, but they wanted to do it themselves, I trained them in how to do qualitative analysis, which was a lot of fun and became a much more of a... I've been doing qualitative studies now for about 20 years, and this was a very different experience for me because it wasn't just training them in how to do the analysis. They sort of trained me and what Priscilla Ridgway, who's one of my colleagues back at Yale, calls theoretical sensitivity. So, for example, there were a couple of stories in our data about women who had lost custody of their children. And there were two women on the team who had lost custody of their children. And that precipitated quite a long and moving discussion of what that experience is like, and how it's a life-changing experience, and you're never the same after that. And so they resonated, if I could use that term, with the data in a way that I could not, and that actually very much enriched the analysis process in a way that I was not used to. So it was a mutual learning experience. And I provided logistical support. Yes?
Bonjour. Moi, je veux juste demander à M. Robinson ce qu'il pense des gens, quand on a un problème comorbide, par exemple, une toxicomanie par rapport avec un problème de schizophrénie. Puis dans le cadre de cette recherche-ci, qu'est-ce qu'on fait si quelqu'un consomme, puis il se présente, puis il veut être dans la recherche?
Well, this could be a longer conversation. The brief answer is it's the same thing I would do if I were trying to be helpful to this person in his or her life, and I would say what I had learned in my own training was there's nothing I can do or say right now that will make you sober, and until you are, you can't really participate in this process, so go home and come back when you're sober. That's not a very satisfactory response, I understand, but I would tell that to any colleague who showed up intoxicated or high, expecting to participate in a research project. I'd send them home and say, come back when you're sober.
I would like to know if in the States you have a budget, because you mentioned you have you ask people what they would like to do with the money. Do you have alternative groups to psychiatry? That is my question.
Do we have
alternative groups?
Do we have alternative groups? Yes. We increasingly in the United States we have more and more alternative groups. In Connecticut in particular, we have peer support groups and we have mutual support groups. We only have at this point two consumer run programs that some people would consider alternative. Why you want to do that? I answer the phone? Okay. So, yes, there are more and more self-help type resources, but in Connecticut there are only two programs that actually receive funding to be consumer-run programs. There are some states in which New Jersey, I think, has more like 25 such programs. So there's a lot of variability across states, just like in Canada there's variability across provinces. Ontario has many more alternative resources than Quebec, as I understand. Now I'm supposed to answer the phone? How do I answer it? Oh, hello? Yes. Okay. Great question. Now what do I do? Okay, I'm going to rephrase your question and then I'll try to answer it. All right. Dr. DeLerm's question was, well, first his comment was it's very interesting to hear the perspective of people in recovery. We don't really hear that perspective enough as policymakers, so it was very helpful. But it was concerning, troubling, because it suggests very different implications for how practitioners should practice from what the current policy emphasis on evidence-based practices has been. He didn't say evidence-based, but I'm assuming he mentioned medication adherence and things like that. Things that clinicians have been encouraged to focus on more recently. So how have we dealt with that issue? And that's a great question. It's certainly been a very lively tension in Connecticut for about the past 6 or so years as we've done more and more of this kind of work. And that's one reason I find this study to be one of the more exciting ones I've been involved in my career, because I think it does generate new implications for practice, which we're just starting to try to tease out. What we've done in Connecticut is, first, we've tried to resolve this discrepancy between evidence-based medicine and recovery-oriented care. And I actually gave grand rounds on that at McGill a couple weeks ago, because they're not at all antagonistic or mutually exclusive. We've also, in Connecticut now, spent about the past 5 to 6 years gathering data, empirical, numerical, quantitative data, showing how recovery support services improve outcomes and decrease the need for clinical, traditional clinical care. So we've been able to show to the legislature, to the governor's office, and to our practitioner community, our provider community, how offering people this kind of recovery guide, recovery mentor, peer support provider who can help them find their way in the world decreases their need for acute detox, decreases their need for acute inpatient care, increases their use of methadone and other helpful medications. So we've been able to back it up with having evidence to show that these are also evidence-based practices. They're just newer to the field, and they're in the process of generating an evidence base. The major challenge with clinicians is helping them understand that this doesn't devalue them. It doesn't take away their skills. It offers them a different framework for offering the expertise that they have. And it means they have to get out of their offices. That's been the primary barrier, is people need to get out of their offices. They don't want to leave their offices because doing community-based work is a lot messier than sitting in your office, but it's also a lot more helpful. So I would say the major barrier has not been convincing people of the value of these kinds of services. The main barrier has been convincing them that they need to be providing these services rather than having other people provide the services in addition to what they do. So they want to keep doing what they're doing, but then add on top of it all these new services, which might have been possible 6 years ago when we had a budget surplus, but certainly is not possible now when we have a huge budget deficit and we're cutting services right and left. There's no foreseeable chance in the future of adding new services on top of existing services. So the challenge we have faced is reallocating existing services to fund this more recovery-based or community-based, recovery-oriented type services, and that has meant less clinical care, but it has been shown to be as or more effective than clinical care.
I'll take a last remark from the back, and then...
And
we'll
I'd be happy to discuss this further with you, Dr. Delarme, should you be interested. Yes.
Well, my question was, I'll do this in French. Qu'est-ce qui cause qu'on a des rechutes après qu'on a eu une consommation ou d'alcool ou de drogue?
In a mental illness?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Oh.
Sorry. I mean, there may be somebody here who thinks they do know, but I think one thing I've learned is how little we actually do know in psychiatry. There are lots and lots of people trying to figure that out, but I'm certainly not an expert in that area. There may be people at the Douglas who would be better prepared to answer that. There may be some neurochemical process going on, but I don't know.
Actually, to answer your question, the research, what little there is, has developed there's three primary things. That the third most significant influence in relapse is peer pressure and other people, their friends, encouraging them to use. The second factor is stressful life events. Something bad happens, so people relapse. But the most common reason why people relapse is they have negative thoughts. They think negatively about themselves, their situation, their future, low self-esteem, poor self-image, lack of opportunity in the community. Negative thinking is the number one reason people relapse, at least in the few studies that I've looked at.
Thank you.
And now, the very, very last comment before break. C'est ça, moi j'aimerais savoir, quand vous faites vos recherches, est-ce que vous séparez, mettons, ceux qui ont un problème de santé mentale sans comorbidité ou si c'est tout dans le même paquet? Est-ce que les personnes qui ont un problème de consommation, quand vous faites votre recherche, c'est séparé d'avec les personnes qui ont un problème de santé mentale ou si c'est, vous ne faites pas de distinction entre les deux?
We do not. Our impression has been that co-occurring substance use is so prevalent that it would be hard to separate people out. And just because you have a mental illness and you use substances does not mean you have a substance use disorder, although the literature seems to conflate the two. So we do not make such determinations, and we do not exclude people based on that.
Parce que, en fin de compte, ça peut fausser l'interprétation des résultats, parce que quand on n'est pas en consommation, les personnes qui n'ont pas de problème avec la consommation ne réagissent pas de la même façon avec les services et tout ça, là. Fait que en tout cas, moi, ce que je vois, c'est que ça peut fausser les choses, là.
I'd be happy to talk with you about that further, but I'm not sure in what ways you're concerned about the... People can... Steve may know more about this than I do, but in my experience, no two people are alike, whether they have the same diagnosis or they both use substances. So I haven't found that to be as important a factor in differentiating people in terms of their response as lots of other things equally important. Like family background or other issues. So you may be drawing a harder and faster distinction than I am, but in Connecticut at least there's a lot of ambiguity about diagnosis. You know, people's diagnoses change over time, people's substance use changes over time, so I would be reluctant to make such black and white distinctions.
Thank you. À la fois M. Petit et M. Davidson.